what's the present day Quaker view on firearms? For instance, well, for hunting and things like that. Firearms today. What's the Quaker's view on? Well, for instance, for hunting.
Well, I'll tell you a sad contemporary story. Over here at near Media, there's a Quaker family. The father of the family is a small farmer, raises vegetables and so on. Somebody had been stealing his corn, sweet corn, at night. He got mad about it, had a gun. He heard a rustling in his cornfield, shot, killed the man. Arrested, tried. His son had told his father he'd be a lot better off if he'd get rid of that gun. And the father himself, I guess, thought so, didn't he? Very uncomfortable man, that man was. And the only man that was equally uncomfortable, I know, was the judge that had to sentence him. He was a man thoroughly respectable in every gun. That doesn't answer your question.
No, well,
no, there's no overall rule. And obviously, for hunting, in New Hampshire in 1702, there were some forts built, and all the white people except the Quakers went to those forts. They lived disarmed, alone, at home. None of them suffered. But in general, firearms, they're more of a temptation than a comfort from the Quaker point of view.
Yeah, well, I meant, for instance, for hunting, while sporting.
Oh, for sporting. Well, that's quite different.
I mean, will they then own?
There are accidents, of course, which are regrettable. Loaded firearms for a man doesn't unload his gun when he gets into a canoe and then it falls down, goes off, so on. But this is not a universal rule, yes.
Didn't the Quakers carry this testimony for not preparing for war or not preparing for armament even further and not even lock the door of their houses? In other words, they left the latch out?
I think so. There's a very famous story called Fierce Feathers. The Quakers in the Albany area, to whom a band of Indians came that were marauding the white settlements. They happened to turn up at the meeting house just at meeting time. They peeped in the door. They saw the men and women sitting there in absolute silence. They looked around. There were no firearms anywhere in evidence. The Quakers came in and sat down. The Indians came in and sat down the meeting till it was over. And then, by means of an interpreter, these were French-speaking Indians, one of the friends could talk to them and found out they'd come with the intention of scalping all the people in the meeting. And when they saw them disarmed, they just didn't do anything. They were invited home to dinner and went away. The next is obviously a subject which lends itself to a good deal of elaboration. Takes various forms. The Quakers did their best in trying to influence governments to take the peace point of view. Time of crisis, they visited the kings and emperors and so on. The traveling friends went through Europe. Men like William Allen, Stephen Burlett, and so on, were constantly talking to foreign rulers. And of course, it's greatly easier to talk to a foreign ruler than it is to your own government. We found that many times. But they, most friends, have faithfully attempted to influence their own government. And so far as they're members of the Parliament in England or Congress in America, they could exert their influence that way.
Have there been very many Quaker congressmen?
Not very many. And not many of them as good Quakers in this as you would expect. There's something about Quakerism that hadn't fitted the American scene very well. But there have been a few that were quite conscientious. We had a a Quaker in the lower house just before the present session of Congress. Two of them. They're on an absolute peace program, disarmament program. Peace societies. Educational plans for getting people of like mind together and organizing peace societies. Always after a big war, there's a peace sentiment in the general public. And in 1815 and 1816, after the Napoleonic Wars, both in England and America, peace societies were formed largely manned by Quakers. Peace literature, printed. Very interesting to look back over the history of the English publication of peace literature. And you'll find that most of the early pieces in the PIECES, in the field of literature, are Quaker origin. Promotion of arbitration. You may remember that there were two World Conferences about 1900, and English Quakers and American Quakers were quite active in encouraging those. They were government conferences, but to help. And the establishment of the World Court. Antecedents to the League of Nations, you already know about in Penn's essay and Feller's essay, and I don't need to say very much about that. The illustration of the alternative in practice. Both as individuals and where they have control of a government, and in action which is not quite so directly anti-war, but rather illustrative of another type of international dealing. For example, in any war, it's possible for the Quakers to work for the prisoners of war. There were Norwegians in England in 1812, and the Quakers organized relief for them, visited them, and incidentally took them books, and these poor fishermen who were interned there, many of them went home and started Quakerism in Norway. That's how Quakerism began in Norway. During the First World War, a great many Germans, Austrians, were imprisoned in England. And the friend organized collectively here quite a committee to look after interned people. During the Second World War, all the Japanese Americans were evacuated from their homes on the West Coast and interned in camps. They were, in a sense, prisoners of war. The friends organized then various kinds of help for these camps full of Japanese Americans. And then, of course, the war with its ravages in the war area does a lot of damage to civilians. And going back over a great many years, the friends have organized relief for the civilians who have suffered because of the war. When Boston was held by the British during the Revolutionary War, the Pennsylvania Friends sent up relief to the Friends in New England to distribute to the people that were sufferers from the British occupation of that territory. I guess those countries had to forget, those territories had to forget what they thought of the Quakers a century before. Because they accepted this relief and welcomed it. I've already mentioned this aspect of Joseph Sturge's work in Finland, and there have been other examples, and particularly in modern times, beginning in the First World War, English and American friends have thoroughly organized for relief work to people suffering from the war, largely refugees, from their home countries, scattered abroad, and under other situations like that. It was this work that led to the award of the Nobel Peace Prize to two groups of friends. Here's a picture you might like to look at. The gold medal isn't in our hands at the moment, but there's a picture of it, and of the scroll, and of the box the scroll, the prize is in. But the award to the friends in 1947, the Nobel Peace Prize, was in recognition, I think, of this feature of their peace testimony, the last feature I have on the board, rather than of their abstract pastus. The award was made because it was felt that this was an illustration of the alternative to the practice of war, and was done in that spirit. Of course, humanitarian work can be done for very different reasons, but what the friends have done in this sort has been closely allied to their whole idea about war and the alternative of reconciliation and friendship. And when possible, they have attempted to work with the people who are or have been the official enemies of their own country. During the First World War, for example, they began their work in France. They couldn't get into Germany, but they got to Germany as soon as they could, and found need of work there. Later in the term, I'll be saying something about the relief work with friends of this sort. And it is a chapter that's near enough to your time for you to know already something about it. Now, don't let the proportion of time I've given to the positive side of the peace testimony give you the impression that I think it's less important than the negative. I'm right in saying that the peace testimony begins, like other friends' testimonies, with the negation of an evil, and then the practice of the good, corresponding good. I have here a list of topics which you might like to look at today, and I'll talk about the use of them later. They're suggested for papers. No longer than those you've written, but in this case, on subjects rather than on persons. And you might like to take those when you go. I need hardly say this is the last of the current papers in the course, and we'll be due on the 13th of May. Or early. And you have books?